Coming up, what an excellent day for teamwork. Well, howdy folks, and welcome to Minute 109 of The Exorcist Minute, a show where we endeavor to examine, extrapolate, and excavate The Exorcist, minute by terrifying minute. My name is Lester Ryan Clark.
And I'm Keenan Diaz.
And we'll be your holy guides on this journey through what some have called the scariest movie of all time. Okay, so our minute begins with Howdy's face emerging from behind the bedpost.
And it ends with more laugh sobbing from the hag. I mean, Mercedes McCambridge.
No, Keenan, I think you mean the hag. I think we've summoned her, and I think she's here to stay.
No exercising of the hag.
No.
No power can compel her, I don't think. She is in the cathedral, and that's that. But folks, let's get back to the top of this minute. Remember, speaking of creepy voices, remember Howdy's voice had just changed to resemble a dying tape player as the two priests kneel and begin crossing themselves. Marin makes the sign of the cross over Reagan, and we begin crossing the bed as the camera pans right. For a moment, the bedpost obscures our view. Then, Reagan slash Howdy's hideous face emerges like an anglerfish from behind a rock. But this anglerfish is sick, possibly dying. Marin has taken part of his stole and leans over to wipe the vomit off of Reagan. But Howdy flinches away as if he can't bear Marin's touch. We cut, and we are met with a hideous visage. We are once again on the other side of the bed, and we are getting the full treatment here. That face that Linda Blair is making is just for us. Nobody else in that room is seeing what we're seeing. Before we continue, what do you think of this little bit, Keenan, from the flinching from Marin's touch to the face, both the character of Howdy and the acting of Linda Blair?
Well, I'm just thinking about the acting of Linda Blair, like... What this is like an actor's wet dream, right? To be able to have this character where you have to do all of these really sharp turns and be all these different personae, right? You're scared and you're in control and you're like three or four characters inside of each other, right? She's nailing all of that, and it's like, you know, I would hope one day to be able to play Iago. Not the parrot that's taken.
Oh, you know. I wouldn't mind that. That would be also fun.
Yeah. You know what? Yeah. Okay. I'm adding that to my list too. But the Shakespearean Iago, that kind of role where it's like you're so clearly duplicitous, and like you're, you know, Iago is like presenting a face to the audience that is in theory his real self, but then also to Othello, and then also a different one to his wife and to his men that he's leading, etc., and like doing all this stuff in this way that makes sense, right? It's not like, oh, this is just nonsense. Like Iago is one of those roles. But I guess you're right, the parrot does that too. So if I could be in the, they've already made a live action Aladdin. Yeah. But the parrot doesn't talk for some reason.
Gilbert Godfrey's character doesn't talk?
Yes, Iago does not talk in the live action remake.
What the fuck is the point of that?
I don't know, Lester. But when they do a real live action performance, real live action remake, and just Iago, I'll put my hat in the ring for that, please.
There you go. Yeah. But no, Keenan, you're absolutely right. For me, this is another testament to Linda Blair's acting. I don't know if we had said it on the show before, but like playing a possessed person is such an interesting challenge, and everyone approaches it differently. There are so many factors, so many things that you got to think about, right? Because you are essentially playing two characters who have the same face and the same body. And the question of who has control of the face and when and why and for how long, right, is such a fascinating game to play. Is the person mostly in control and the demon blinks in and out occasionally? Is the demon always in control but is pretending to be the person and fooling everyone? Does the demon use the face differently than the person? like when Craig T. Nelson got possessed in the second Poltergeist movie by Julian Beck's character, Reverend Kane, I remember thinking, man, he has got Julian Beck's smile and his eyes, the way he looks at things, his voice, not just like the things he says, but the way he talks. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So there's always the question of ratio, like how many parts the demon and how many parts the person do I put into this performance? Mm-hmm. And then within that ratio, are they struggling? Is the person compliant? Are they collaborating? Mm-hmm. Like these
like,
are
mixologists, right? Like you're like your bartender. Yeah. Which again is like the role that most actors have rather than one of these really good roles. Most actors are bartenders and have to think of this just in terms of like literal drinks rather as opposed to these really complex questions of possession characters. So
Right. One day, possessed bartender. But yeah, so these are all questions that I would have, right? Mm-hmm. And it feels like going back to, you know, to like Linda Blair's acting here, it feels like she has decided in this moment that she is 100% Howdy.
Mm-hmm.
She is playing a demon, but not just that. She is playing a demon in pain. Now, how do you play a demon in pain who has no face of his own and has to stare out from behind this face that he stole? But that is what she's doing. But it also looks like they have been disconnected to a point where, like, neither Howdy nor Reagan can control the face, and it's just, like, frozen in this wide-eyed, open mouth. It looks like a mask, you know? It looks like the face itself is dead or frozen, and by contrast, Howdy's eyes look frantic and alive as he peers out from behind. What do you think?
Yeah, this is a pretty stunning look on Linda Blair, Captain Howdy's face, right? Like, I guess because Howdy Reagan is looking towards us, right? Like this look of absolute pain and like being lost, like it's like a 1,000-yard stare, but also having this like physical reaction with this puke coming out of the mouth, right?
Right, right.
So it's like, which we don't normally put together. Normally the 1,000-yard stare is like, nothing's going on in my body and my mind is somewhere else. And this is, this is like, oh, I'm writhing in pain and puking out this terrible, or not even puking out, it's just leaking out, like oozing out of me, right? Mm-hmm, but because it's not, I don't know, Maren can't see it, Damien can't see it, only we can see it. So it must be real, right? Based on our Shakespearean rules. So like, yeah, it is surprising how much I feel for this demon here. Like, oh, this poor thing. It's like watching a little bug getting squished or something, or, you know, like completely powerless and like clearly in a lot of pain. And it's a very brief moment. So probably in the full context, when you're watching the scene properly, the audience probably isn't thinking that exact same thing. But when we're looking at it shot by shot, I'm like, oh, this is really kind of, it's like a snuff film or something, you know, like we have her tied up and we're like killing her. It's like, oh, just for a brief little flash, like, oh, this poor thing. What has she ever done to anybody?
Right.
it's been all like a year since in Exorcist Minute, movie by minute time, since she killed Burke Dennings.
Right. Yeah. Right. We've completely forgotten about that. It's like, what has she done recently? Like,
to a character that we've seen recently.
Burke who? Come on.
Yeah, but I guess my main point is like, yeah, she, like this pain feels real because it's not like I'm putting this on for the sake of the priest, because the priests aren't even getting the benefit of this.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That was the first thing that came to my mind. I think this is definitely another Shakespeare moment, right? Because nobody else can see that face except us. We are that third priest, right?
Right.
And it's interesting. I didn't have that that same kind of like feeling of pity here. I have had it before. I've had it for Reagan, and I've had it that one time, I think it was in the last minute, when we have the Captain Howdy face and he flashes on for just a second and he's looking up at Maren like with this begging, pleading look, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This one, I can't see it any other way other than Howdy is like deep inside there. I don't think the face is on. I think the face is a husk. I think the face is like a shell. I think it's been like, I think neither Reagan nor Howdy have access to the face right now. And it's just kind of like frozen. It's like, have you ever seen, you know, like on the show, dinosaurs, like those big giant Jim Henson, you know, Muppets, right? Or even, or even like if you're talking about like a little Muppet or something like that, when, you know, the camera goes off and they take their heads off, or they, or they like, they stop worrying about making facial expressions and they're just, their faces just freeze.
Right.
That's what I'm seeing. It's like Howdy is unable to get to the facial mechanisms, and so is Reagan. So it's just like off.
Right.
Which is scary. And then, and then like now, you know, the stuff is oozing out of the face. And, you know, that gets me wondering. Well, okay, so so Marin has taken the stole and he has tried to place part of it on maybe Reagan's forehead, but Howdy has jerked away from it. But he can't go far with those straps. And you, you get the feeling that this time the straps are actually effective. Like Howdy can't remove the straps now. Howdy would get away if he could, but he can't.
Yeah, that I'm wondering about, because I think I'm thinking ahead. Like, it does feel absolutely straps are working, but just thinking ahead in a couple of minutes, like, then the straps are meaningless. And
You know.
But right now, definitely it feels like, yes, they're actually working. This could really work. The ritual could work. The straps work. Everything can work.
Yeah. He's on the ropes literally and figuratively now. And yeah, we're gonna see what happens to the straps a little bit later, but I think that's him rallying. I think right now he's not like holding back. He's not pretending like he can't get away. I don't think he can. But like, even with his face turned away, Marin is still able to place the end of that stole on Reagan's shoulder and then place his hand on the side of her head. And we get the sense that even that is hurting Howdy. As soon as he has placed it on her head, his vomit starts flowing out of Reagan's mouth. I believe in the book, Blatty likens it at this point to lava. And I like how it's not like shooting out. Like you said, it's just kind of oozing out.
Yeah. It's not being used as a weapon. It's not whoever's in this body is not in control of it. Right.
Right. You get the sense that Howdy isn't doing this on purpose.
Right.
Like, it's like he's bleeding. Like he's not spitting it at anyone. It's more like he's hemorrhaging. Right. Like Reagan's body is rejecting him, almost like the green stuff is him.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. So they're winning, and it's so the more of this stuff you get out, the better, I suppose.
Yeah, right.
Which is interesting, right? Because so far we've seen with the green stuff as being this this weapon. So it's not like, okay, like when Captain Howdy spits on Dimmy, right? It's not like, oh, good, you know, less green stuff inside of Reagan, the better. We don't have that kind of thought at all, right?
No. And I like, maybe that's at a time when, like, you know, it's just like production of the green stuff is up, you know, 400%. So, you know, he can, you know, waste a little bit. but yeah, and then he spits it in Marin's face, and now it's just like oozing out. And I can't help but feel like this is like the actual purpose of vomit, right? It's getting out the bad stuff. It's pushing out the invading entity that is in your body, right?
Right. Can I share some Latin with you?
Sure.
All right, this is apparently an often cited Latin phrase in medicine. I don't know Latin pronunciation, so I apologize ahead of time.
Okay.
Ubi pus, ibi evacua. There you say it. And what that means is, where there is pus, evacuate it. So that's like this phrase in medicine. I forget where I came across this, but like the thought is like, hey, if there's pus in there, you better just get it out. Like, don't worry about there's no good reason to have that in there.
Right.
So it's not like, oh, should I, shouldn't I, whatever. It's like, if you're able to do that without damaging people, you should do it.
Right. This isn't, you know, the days of like, oh, I have black bile and I have humors and I have, you know, and it's like, I should keep them all balanced. It's like, no, get it out.
Right. The balance. Yeah, I guess so. Even back way, way back then, they didn't think there was any positive nature to pus. Yeah.
And that's just so fascinating. It took me a really, really long time. I think I was like maybe in high school, before I realized that, you know, like our mucus, our snot, our pus, sorry, folks, is made by us to capture and expel the germs. Like you associate a runny nose with like, oh, you have a cold. A cold brings the runny nose. No, it doesn't. A cold makes your body produce the runny nose. That is like a weapon for you against the germs. Like the, you know, the snot and the pus and all that stuff is your body like taking care of it. And the reason it looks all gross and green is because it's filled with all the viruses and all the bacteria and it's like, you know, being, you know, expelled from your body. And that's immediately where my mind went with this is that like something or someone is pushing Howdy out. You know, maybe it's Reagan, maybe it's the power of God, maybe it's these two priests, but something is expelling the essence of Howdy and it's coming out in this vomit. And again, we know how the rest of this exorcism goes. We know that like this isn't the end. He's still going to be in there, but it does feel like he's bleeding or he is wounded. And this is the result.
Well, yes. So I hear you with the idea that, your body is creating snot, phlegm, mucus, even like inflammation, swelling, et cetera, in order to get rid of the diseases. But I don't know if you've heard of this this other hypothesis that's all the devil because you've been bad.
Oh,
that is all of your sins inside of you, and you're a dirty, dirty child. I don't know if you've considered that.
I mean, you know what? I shall take it under consideration. I will. Why is my body temperature rising with this virus? Is it just getting me ready for the flames of hell? Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's tenderizing you.
Yeah. But no, and like that's another thing is like the like a fever is you. That's your body. That's your body doing that. Right. Like trying to like boil the germs out of you. Right.
Yeah. Well, tell it to Louis Pasteur in hell, you sick child.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, is that what you were like? You were quoting Louis Pasteur. Is that what it is?
No.
Oh, no.
Louis Pasteur is a doctor. Yeah. He didn't come up with germ theory, but he was the one who was like, hey, you know, if when you're going into surgery, fellow doctors, could I recommend washing your hands before you go into surgery? And they were like, what? I've been doing this for 40 years, right? And then I have all this.
I've only lost 700 patients.
But there was also this sort of like, you know, I don't know how cognizant the doctors were, but this idea like I'm out there saving lives and that's this bodily thing that I'm doing with my skill. And to question my hands is like an affront to this. Like my hands are life-saving materials, right? You know, blessed by God. Right. And so what are you talking about? Like my hands are dirty and I should just wash them with soap. Yeah.
Schoolboy. Jeez.
Yeah, fancy pants schoolboy.
Yeah, that's what
Louis Pasteur.
Yeah. Sorry, of course I knew that Louis Pasteur was a doctor. I was thinking of his brother Louis Pasteur.
Right. I drink pasteurized milk. Lester drinks pasteurized milk.
Yes. Any way I can get into heaven at this point, folks. Like, this is human kindness flavor. So we're back at the side of this bed. And Merrin says, "See the cross of the Lord, begone, you hostile power." And Howdy's head jerks around again to look at Merrin, more vomit flowing freely from his mouth. Now, Keenan, what do we make of this turn towards Merrin as he says, "See the cross of the Lord"? Is Howdy compelled to obey, and that's why he's turned, or is it just like more struggling, like he's pulling this way and that way, or is this another pleading look to Merrin, like we saw with the other face, like his true face? Or is it like a look of defiance? Like is that the best you can do? You know,
I still feel like there isn't any person in there right now or any person in control. It feels like really involuntary. Like it's such a violent jerk, but like a spasm, of a dying person.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And that puke is just still oozing out, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. If it was a look of defiance, his facial features would change, right? He would frown or he would snarl. But no, it's like the exact same face that we saw in the other cut.
And you know, if it were defiance, I mean, Marin is within biting distance, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Marin's hand is just on the forehead, but, you know, it's not like snarling up and snapping like a turtle or anything. It seems to be, no one's at home right now.
Yeah, it's an empty shell. I really like that analogy, yeah. Mm-hmm. Or like a mask that is slipping, and now you see that it's just a mask. In any case, we got more choking and gagging noises from Howdy, even as his labored breathing continues. I like how the breathing and the choking noises are happening at the same time. Again, like Howdy is a demon with many mouths, many voices, many faces, right? We cut, and it's as if we are now standing at the bottom right corner of the bed, looking at Marin as he says again, "Oh Lord, hear my prayer." And then Dimmy rushes into frame, rushes to his aid, and he says, "And let my cry come unto thee." I love it. This is Dimmy the hero. He is back in it. He is with Marin 100%. This is teamwork. Marin was the hero and Dimmy was the protagonist. And in this movie, those were two different things. But when he stepped into that frame, all I could think was Dimmy the hero, because his praying has also changed. Mm-hmm. And Keenan, and folks, you too, tell me if I'm just like making things up. But throughout this prayer, his way of praying has changed. It's gone through stages, like his character evolution in microcosm. His voice has been doubtful, timorous, fearful. Then you start to hear conviction mixed with the fear. This is the knight in training. Deliver us from the evil one in the face of the enemy. He has seen the face of the enemy, the face of the dragon. And so his voice had been louder, still shaky, but with like a little bit of command behind it. And now this feels like the third evolution, where something has clicked and he somehow understands that how the words sound don't matter as much as the ritual itself, which is a good thing, right? Like, does this make sense? Like, you can hear the strain as he reaches over and then bends to put his hand on Reagan. He's not trying to copy Marin anymore. Mm-hmm. That was the first step, was matching Marin's energy, right? And he was like, deliver us from the evil one in the face of the enemy. And he was, he had conviction behind that. But now, somehow, either by watching Marin or maybe something just clicked, he understands that it doesn't matter how the words sound. Marin sounds like that because he's Marin. Right? Marin's not putting a false bravado behind his words to psych himself up. It's coming genuinely from inside because that's who he is and how he's feeling right now. Mm-hmm. Dimmy saw that and heard that and matched it, which helped him out of his own head. But now he's in a place where he can just be himself. He doesn't have to be Marin. He can't be Marin. Mm-hmm. So he is now speaking as Dimmy. And he is not ashamed of Dimmy's voice. He is beginning to understand, at least unconsciously, that a hero isn't worried about how he sounds. He just does. His actions speak for him.
I'm remembering when I was in college and my acting teacher, Clarence Gilliard, once asked the class, he said, So who here, when you're getting, we're all beginning acting students, right? So
yeah.
Who here, as they're getting ready for the role and preparing for their role, is primarily concerned with how the lines sound? And, everyone kind of understands that he's saying that that's wrong, right? It's just in the nature of but I raised my hand and like me. And he was like, well, the point is like, no, like that's going to get you basically as a parrot. It's not going to really, what you should be focusing on is the intention, your objective, what you're trying to get from the other character, et cetera. What the words mean to you as you're saying them, et cetera. And I've struggled with that as someone who does spend a lot of work on accent work and trying to think about how characters breathe, et cetera, like to square those things together. Cause I, obviously he is correct. Like the more important things for an actor is what the words mean to you and not just how you are, how you sound as you're saying it. Like, cause then if you're worried too much about how you sound as you're saying it, then you're just, you're never quite present. Right. You're like thinking about like, am I nailing this accent? Am I doing, am I doing the, like, how are people perceiving me rather than, like, what am I trying to get from these lines?
Right. I have that exact same problem, Keenan.
I don't think it's a problem. I think it's a strength. This is us. This is our process.
Yes. If you don't like it, no. But, I think it comes from a lot of my early training when like we were doing stuff like on the stage, like Shakespeare and other things where it was so important to sound a certain way and to pronounce a certain way and to have a certain rhythm and to like really kind of acknowledge and like validate every single word of the play. And so you're that's hammered into you. And I mean, like, I'm not saying that, you know, my theater teachers were absolutely right about this. Like there might be like, other schools, even for like stage acting in Shakespeare, but that was how it was taught to me. But actually, Keenan, it's funny that you mentioned this, like the intentionality of, the lines in acting. I couldn't help but think like, as Dimmy says this, this line of the prayer and let my cry come unto thee. I couldn't help but think about different methods of acting, specifically like method versus Meisner, and then also prayer. There's some kind of connection between acting and praying, at least for me. I don't know if I'm crazy right now, but when I was younger, I would stop in the middle of a prayer and start over because I felt like I wasn't feeling it enough. I wasn't thinking and feeling every word. And Keenan, that was torture because like a simple prayer would take like an hour. Growing up, my family suspected that we might have OCD. Although now I kind of wonder if it wasn't like ADHD or maybe like a combo of both. But that would creep into like multiple parts of my life. And that, plus the Catholic guilt, it was just like torture to try to say a prayer because like I never felt like I meant it enough or I didn't have like this person's face like firmly in my mind when I was, you know, asking God to bless them or something. And for that reason, I would stop praying for a long time. And like I would always come back to it, but it was always like I was trying to do method praying, like method acting. And it wasn't until this book. It's when Karis has dinner with Dyer in the refectory, and it's just two friends talking, and you wouldn't even know that they were priests, except Karis says grace before he sits down. But okay, listen to how it's written. He showered, scrubbing briskly, slipped on a white t-shirt and khaki chinos, then ambled to dinner in the priest refectory, where he spotted pink-cheeked Dyer, wearing a faded Snoopy sweatshirt. He was sitting alone at a table in a corner. Karis moved to join him. Hi, Damien. Hey, Joe. Standing in front of his chair, Karis blessed himself and closed his eyes while inaudibly murmuring a rapid grace, then sat down at the table and spread a napkin on his lap. How's the loafer? Dyer asked him. What do you mean? I'm working. One lecture a week? It's the quality that counts. What's dinner? Can't you smell it? Karis grimaced. Oh, hell. Is it dog day? I really do think that was the moment, Keenan. I was like, oh, these are priests. Like, and he said grace, like, so casually.
Right.
And if they can do it casually, you know. And that actually made me feel a lot better. Like I didn't have to, like, you know, feel the spirit running through me every time I say grace or, you know, go to church, right? I don't have to do method praying. God isn't Lee Strasberg. Right? And I said unto him, this is the covenant we have chosen. And I didn't ask where he was when I laid the Earth's foundation because it had nothing to do with business.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Like method as like method acting sounds like penitence, you know, to you. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's very interesting. And it kind of is. I mean, that's why some people give up on certain versions of method acting is it ruins them emotionally.
Yeah, yeah. And to simplify it, folks, like what I'm talking about is Karras isn't like trying to feel the emotion before he says the words anymore, mm-hmm. right? He knows that he can just say the words and the words will it's outside in versus inside out. He knows mm-hmm. that saying the words will bring him to a place.
Mm-hmm. That the good works are enough in some situations, right? Because it's faith in good works. And if you don't have faith, at least try the good works. And if you don't have the good works, at least try the faith, right?
Yeah, right.
And you don't have to get the perfect trifecta all the time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. But Keenan, that is the amazing thing, right? Getting back to this story, I didn't realize it until doing this show, but I think that's how Dimmy felt too.
Mm-hmm.
Like I didn't realize it when I first read the book, but he's, you know, he's mumbling the prayer, he's mumbling grace, right, very, very quickly before he sits down. And he's feeling bad that he doesn't feel anything, right? Mm-hmm. And then he meets Marin, and somehow Marin is able to like mumble prayers, mm-hmm. but you know he's fucking praying. Right?
Right.
It's like when you see a master actor like Anthony Hopkins or mm-hmm. or Max von Sydow, who just like says the words and makes it look so easy. He's mm-hmm. not trying. He's not like building up emotion before saying something. He's just doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like I imagine if you attended two masses, right? One was conducted by Marin and one was conducted by like middle of the movie Dimmy,
uh-huh.
right? And Dimmy is really trying, right? Like his mom just died and he is trying to see God and he puts some like oomph into it, right? And he's acting like he thinks a priest should act,
mm-hmm.
but you don't feel anything coming off of him. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Versus you go to the Marin Mass and he's up there and he's like, you know, making grandpa jokes and he's talking about a duck named Clancy that he used to have as a kid. That is actually from the book, by the way. Right.
Yeah. Well, tell me more about this duck named Clancy.
It's a I think it's a single sentence. Hang on. OK, is it found it? OK, so mm-hmm. so it says I think this is like during a break in the exorcism, it says, through the hours, the elderly exorcist had said very little. Now and then, a homely story of his boyhood, reminiscences, little things, a story about a duck he once owned named Clancy. Yeah. So just a little, you know, it's like, Marin was a kid once. He used to have a duck, you know?
What's it to you?
Yeah. So that's what I meant. Like he's up there, right? Mm-hmm. The older Marin, right? Like as the priest, and he's doing the mass, and he's just talking, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But you feel God in his words, mm-hmm. right? In his silly little stories, in his laugh, mm-hmm. right? And then mass is over, and you know you're filing out with the rest. And when I was growing up, right, the priest would be like by the door, and everyone mm-hmm. would be like, you know, shaking his hand as they go out, right? And maybe you're not a people person, right? But he's like right at the exit, and everyone's doing it. So you reach out to shake his hand, and he looks you in the eye, and he thanks you for coming, and you're like, ugh, 'cause you just felt something. Mm-hmm. Like it was the same thing that the tea shop owner felt. It's mm-hmm. the same thing that his friend Jesuit Dean felt when they embraced each other for the last time. It's mm-hmm. the same thing Chris felt when this guy showed up at her door. This guy is real.
Mm-hmm.
He's the real deal. He's not acting the way a priest should act. He is a priest, right? He wouldn't know the first thing about acting like a priest, right?
Right.
He just acts like Lancaster Marin, who once had a duck, right? and God just inhabits that and flows through that. And I feel like in this minute, Dimmy is finally starting to understand that too. He's finally understanding that he becomes Father Damien Karras by being true to Dimmy.
Mm-hmm.
And folks, I'm surprised we didn't pick up on this sooner. I'm realizing this right now. Keenan,
mm-hmm.
this character has manifested three personalities. This is so perfect. Like he's talking about Reagan manifesting three personalities, but
right.
he's the one with three different handles, right? Which he uses depending on who he's talking to. Mm-hmm. So to most people, he is Karras. He is his last name with a doctor or a father in front of it, right? That is how he meets the world.
Or with to his friend. In the book, he forgets to write Society of Jesuits after his name.
Right, right.
Yeah,
with
yeah.
an SJ. Right.
right.
yeah, exactly, exactly. So titles and last names,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
To his friends, like Father Dyer or Father Tom, he is Damien,
mm-hmm.
right? And then there's the one he's ashamed of, the one that he hides away. It's the one that nobody calls him. Well, nobody anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's Dimmy. That's the one that God wants.
Mm-hmm.
That's the real one. He keeps looking for God as Karras, Dr. Karras, Father Karras. And God's like, no, just be Dimmy.
Mm-hmm.
You saw me first as Dimmy. You knew me as Dimmy. Just be Dimmy. And ever since Marin showed up, Damien has been in the process of getting back to God by getting back to Dimmy. Like he really did hop into a time machine, right?
Mm-hmm.
And folks, it hasn't been painless either. His interaction with Marin, being reprimanded by this father figure, seeing the face of the boogeyman, it is not a pleasant process by any means,
mm-hmm.
but he is slowly climbing out of hell.
Well, that's really brilliant, mm-hmm. Lester. I think there's been a lot of commentary about the threefold nature of this movie, which we've pointed out a little bit, right? We have sort of three main characters. There are there is our final scenes are going to be between this trifecta between these three people, right?
Right,
Damien,
right.
Howdy, and Karras.
Right. I've thought of three good themes and three bad ones, right?
Doubt, yeah.
Isolation, despair, conviction, communion, hope. Yeah.
Right. Usually you see people writing about that as being either a reflection or a parody sometimes of the Holy Trinity.
Mm.
Like that's very common in a lot of the exorcist scholarship, right? But yeah, this
right.
idea, I haven't seen that before at all, about the three faces of Damien. So that's really, really fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah. I mean, it's like it's so weird that it took us long enough to kind of like have that epiphany, I guess.
Well,
you know?
This is when Damien starts to realize it. So we're not the only ones
true.
Who are struggling with it. Blame Damien. He's the one you want.
Oh, it's so easy to blame Damien.
Let's keep doing it. Like, I think I've said it on the show before, but just in case. When Homer Simpson is making fun of Ned Flanders, because Ned is the Pee-wee, the Pop Warner football coach for the kids. And Homer's on the sidelines going, boo, you can't coach, you know, et cetera. And Marge says, you know, Homer, it's very easy to judge. And Homer says, yeah, fun too.
And I think we've said it a couple of times, folks, but yeah, like we can't help giving Dimmy a hard time just because he is us. He is our analog in this story, right? And we're seeing all of our, you know, our own human flaws and you know, insecurities in him, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, like it feels so great to see him kind of coming into his own now.
Mm-hmm, right.
Yeah. But yeah, okay, so let's get back into it. So Dimmy has said, and let my cry come unto thee.
Mm-hmm.
We cut, and we are once again that third priest on the opposite side of the bed. Both priests are laying hands upon Reagan. As soon as the words have been said, Marin quickly switches gears and takes off his stole. It looks like he is also trying to, like, scoop up as much of the vomit as possible with it.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that touch. Again, it's not a holy relic. Mm-hmm. Right? Maybe it was when they were saying the words, but now it's just a piece of cloth. There's right. there's no like, oh my God, she vomited on my stole. It's the opposite of that even. It's like, okay, now let me clean her up as much as I can, right? Here, Dimmy, go wash this in the sink, right? He's like, he's being very human now, right? Mm-hmm. I love that the holiest person in the room is being so practical.
Mm-hmm. But, and again, Christian-like. It's not like, oh, my stole, I have to bring this back to the library or I'm going to get a fee or whatever.
Right.
Right. It's like, well, I know that it's practical because like, okay, I know we're going to need this. You know, this has been very helpful. It's going to continue to be very helpful. It's called out in the Roman ritual that you have a purple stole as you're doing this. Right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But then also, yeah, like humble to it, humble to Reagan, like not, it's not like an anger that we're taking this away. And you say like, well, you know, you're kind of paraphrasing. You're like, here, Damien, take this. But that's all thinking of teamwork, this minute's theme, right? It's done wordlessly, right? So they just are.
Yes, exactly.
They're working. You know, sometimes a surgeon has to call out for tools, but sometimes they don't because the scrub nurse just kind of intuits what it's going to be, right? Or they might call out for it and the scrub nurse already has that, right? And that's what it feels like is, yeah, they're working as one machine, one body in simpatico.
Exactly. And like, you know, we're just talking about like Dimmy is growing up really, really fast in these minutes. Like a couple of minutes ago, like Marin was like actually speaking to him and Dimmy didn't even notice.
Right.
Right. Like he had to like the response, please, Damien. Mm-hmm. Right. And now they can communicate. They can work as this machine without exchanging words. Right. So already like Dimmy is stepping up and I really, really love it. Mm-hmm. And I want to go back to what you had said about Marin being like very holy or Christian in this action. Like in the real sense though. Right. Mm-hmm. Like he's putting Reagan first.
Right.
Right. And that's why he's Father Marin. Right. Like you think like we have like the stereotype of Christianity, which is like, you know, it's like, oh, my God, clutch the pearls if somebody like blasphemes or something like that. Right. So like, you know, like the wrong type of Christian would freak out over like the desecration of this holy stole.
Right.
Right. And they would just completely forget the person. Mm-hmm. But he's being the Christian that you are supposed to be, right? Like he doesn't care about this piece of cloth right now. Like he's trying to help Reagan.
Right. The stereotype we have from you know, bad Christians like, is the only way I can think of saying it. But but people who, you know, use Christianity as like a power thing, a weapon, right. There's like this holier than thou idea, and Christianity scripturally is the opposite. Like no one is holier than thou, and you know, you go and pray at home and don't pray in the market so people can see how holy you are.
That's
an affront to Christ according to the scripture.
And even if you're not showing off with it, like I've been guilty of this as well. Mm-hmm. Like seeing the objects or the prayers or the people, like the priests or the nuns or something like that, with this like almost like you got to wash your hands before you touch them, right? And not realizing that those are just things, you know, and like the actual like. Acts of love are what counts, right? Mm-hmm. And so I love that Marin just kind of treats this holy vestment as a vomit rag because that is what is needed for this living human being, this creature of God,
right?
That's the more important thing than you know, whether this you know, piece of cloth is desecrated,
right?
And you notice, folks, he actually acts faster than Dimmy after the prayer is done, right? Like Dimmy keeps his hand on Reagan. He's still unsure. He's still watching Marin. He's still taking cues from him. And he very quickly understands, oh, they don't need that anymore, right? The laying of the hands, right? Mm-hmm. And without Marin saying anything, just like you said, Keenan, he takes the stole and he goes and he washes it in the sink, right? He does look a little bit funny as he is waiting for Marin to hand him this like steaming mess. But we're not laughing at him anymore. Like we feel for him, right? He is doing his best, right? And he doesn't shy away, right? Like he takes that nasty thing and he goes into the bathroom. Right? He also takes Marin's glasses. It took, like, I had to rewatch this a couple of times.
Oh, you're right. You can just,
yeah, you can barely catch that that's what he's grabbing from the table. Mm. And I like that detail, too. Because that means, folks, that means that he is awake now. Mm-hmm. He knows Marin needs those. Right. He's going to go wash those too. And so, yeah, so as he leaves, we see Marin preparing a white cloth to clean Reagan up even more.
Mm-hmm.
And then we cut, and we are in the bathroom, very tight shot. Dimmy enters. We don't even, like, see his full form, right? We just see, like, his torso, right? He puts both the glasses and the stole in the sink, and he turns on the water and frantically begins to wash them. Mm-hmm. He knows that they don't have much time.
It's pretty shocking, isn't it, how much this shot in this bathroom, like, jars us? I mean, because we've been in this bathroom before, but it's just so white, I guess. Like, we have the the light on in the bathroom, and it moves so quickly, and it just like breaks the spell that we've been in when we're in the exorcism room, I suppose, right? Of like, this is a place of supernatural and magic and high stakes, etc. And this is like, oh gosh, we're in a child's bedroom again. Like, it's sort of reminding us of that.
Oh, that is a perfect explanation of it. Mm-hmm. It's like, I understand exactly what you feel, but I couldn't put it into words. But no, you're right. Like, we treat the room where the battle is happening like an ethereal battleground.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
It's no longer Reagan's room. It's, like you said, the exorcism room. Right.
Right. It's the ritual chamber, I suppose. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. And then, you know, Dimmy leaves the frame and he goes into this bathroom, and we're like, oh yeah, there's, like, you know, at first we're like, oh, what's this bathroom doing in the holy chamber? It's right, like, wait a minute, this is a kid's room.
Right. It has all the modern stuff. It has, yeah, it's a modern sink, and it's bright white. And yeah. And if you look closely, there's a Swiss guy in the corner waiting his turn.
Take your time. I am used to waiting. Could you hand me that magazine over the toilet?
Yeah, it's Highlights for Children.
He's just he's on the toilet. He's reading as Dimmy is, like, frantically washing up, and just, like, it's silent for most of it. But at one point he looks up and he's like, "Did you know that the female lion is the one who hunts and not the male?"
Yeah.
"Did you know it's actually the male seahorses who give birth? And not the females. This magazine is so informative."
All right.
"I'm sorry if I'm oversharing. You can probably hear the excitement in my voice."
"Oh, that goofus is up to it again." When I was a kid and I would read Goofus and Gallant, I would really start to skim over. I'm like, this is so formulaic. as like a 5-year-old. Like, we get it. Gallant is going to do everything perfectly, and Goofus is going to goof it up. What else is new?
I like that Carl is... Mm-hmm. He's so dour about everything else, but Goofus and Gallant really just make him smile. Really make him smile on the inside.
That's right. Oh, boy.
"Oh, Goofus, you could always brighten up my day."
Yeah. "This week, Goofus spends his extra money on video games and chewing gum. But Gallant spends his extra money taking 3 buses to his secret daughter and her hideout to give her money for treatment." "That gives me an idea."
Ha 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 ha!
And that's Willie's problem. She's like, yeah. She's like, oh, Carl, must we make every decision based on what Goofus does not do and what Gallant does do? I'm afraid we must, my dear.
We have already made the decision.
It's 3-1, I'm afraid, Willie.
Oh, Carl.
All right. But he's not here right now.
No.
We fixed that in the movie. Carl's not in this bedroom.
No, he's not. Yes. Well, we could check the floors. I mean,
yeah, the hidden Carls. Shoe poking. Yeah, right?
But yeah. Okay, so Dimmy's in there and he's washing up. And we cut again, and yeah, it appears that Howdy is rallying. Mm-hmm. Perhaps it's because he's got Marin momentarily alone.
Yeah.
This is hard to watch. Mm-hmm. This quick shot of Marin getting up and walking from the bed to the other end of the room. He has his hands up over his ears as he tries to block out the noise because Howdy is making all the doors and the windows and the cabinets like slam open and close. Mm-hmm. And his hands are shaking, Keenan.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we talked about everyone becoming a child in the presence of Marin. Marin has just become a child also.
Right, yeah.
His old heart is beating with the ferocity of that little boy who first met the boogeyman.
Mm-hmm.
Because the boogeyman has found him after all these years. And Marin retreats to the other, like, end of the room. He goes right up to the wall. It's so sad. Again, like, it's like seeing your grandpa or your father truly be afraid of something.
Mm-hmm.
It's you shouldn't see those people in your life, like, have those feelings. Right.
Right. And I'm belittling this slightly because you're right. It is so terrifying that I just have to point out that it's sad. It really is. It really is sad. But,
mm-hmm.
I feel like we would be remiss with, because, like, yeah, the cabinets are opening and things are coming. It feels like seeing your grandpa living in Pee-wee's Playhouse, and he's straight up not having a good time. You know, like, everybody else just thinks it's fantastic that all the furniture is like, ah, ah, and grandpa does not care for it, you know? And you can't explain to him why this is happening and that you have to be in on the joke that this is of fun.
See, folks, I'm trying to create this pathos here with this character.
Because then, you know, even the mailman, Lawrence Fishburne is the mailman, comes by and he's like, oh, finally, a government official will put a stop to this. And then even he likes the furniture is screaming. He's like, I got the mail. And guess what it has in here? It has the secret word. This is only madness. This is madness and nothing else.
And then for some reason, like, Howdy's face is green and it comes from a box and he's wearing a turban. He's like, Mecca Lecca High, Mecca High Neo.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, and you just have to be like, no, Grandpa, relax. It's fun. I'm with Grandpa on that one. I did not really care for that show as a kid. I found it terrifying. So I'm with Grandpa on this one.
Oh, so you do sympathize with Marin right now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think I'm bringing up Pee-wee's Playhouse because of all my trauma with Pee-wee's Playhouse.
There we go. Okay.
And me, I was a very serious child.
It,
when you think about, like, when you really think about it, mm-hmm. it is kind of nightmarish.
Absolutely. When I was growing up, I was like, why doesn't every other kid see it this way? This is a nightmare.
Everything in your house is alive.
Yes.
Right?
And then, you know,
smart ass.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's always on. Like, we have friends who are comedians, right? And sometimes you're like, do we have to be on all the time? Like, can't we have a real conversation about what's going on or whatever? And then, imagine if that's your sofa and your refrigerator mm-hmm. being always on.
Everyone in that house is just a struggling actor trying to make it. In LA.
That's right.
And they think Pee-wee is a casting director. So whenever he shows up, it's like, hey, yo.
Right. Follow my new web series.
Yeah. The chair is just like, I do this thing randomly now.
I'm the only one in the county who knows how to do that. It's a very castable skill, isn't it?
Yeah. Portrait on the wall is like, I can cry on cue.
Out, damn spot. Out. Yes. But that's your toilet.
Jeez. Never a moment's peace.
Never a moment's peace.
Pee-wee's Playhouse. The nine circles of Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But like in all seriousness, Keenan, like what do you think of this like very, very brief clip we have of Marin like just losing all of the stuff that mm-hmm. that we love about him.
Yeah.
Like, and becoming this child.
It is disconcerting, right? Because we don't see the transition of like what's happened because we've gone in with Damien. So we don't see like Marin realizing he's losing control. Like he just sort of is standing up and he's already putting his hand in his ears. Like mm-hmm. it's happened so quickly and we mm-hmm. don't see anything that's triggered it in particular. So what is it? Is it that he's lost the stole? Right. Is it that he's lost Damien for a moment? Is it that the demon did something to, we don't see any of that stuff, right?
It's right. just did like, how he say something
or like, give him a look, well, right? How,
yeah. Like
we have no idea what that is. And so yeah, he's just completely lost and standing up and even trying to, he doesn't seem to know where he's going except away.
Right. It, like he has to just move away. It's this very primal, like, again, mm-hmm. like very childlike, like he doesn't even like care how he looks. He just like puts his hands. Okay, what is the hands to the ears? Is it the loudness or is he like trying to drown out the laughing?
Yeah.
Or is he
psychological like, pain? What is it? Right.
And that's just like that motion too. It's like, you know, like putting your hands over your ears mm-hmm. isn't going to block out sound very well.
Right.
Like it's not gonna work.
Or thoughts,
yeah. Right? Like or like I can, you know, I put my fingers in my ears, I can still hear like everything around me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But it's the motion is such a childlike, it's like,
right.
It's like when a child covers his eyes,
mm-hmm.
like when he's scared and he doesn't want to see something
right.
and he wants to disappear. It's like Marin doesn't want to hear or have heard mm-hmm. whatever Howdy like might've said or something like that.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
And it's just like, it's so pitiful. It's so like sad. And we cut and Dimmy comes out of the bathroom and the camera follows him and we see Marin so small on the other end of the room. It mm-hmm. breaks your heart. This little boy hiding in the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I know he's not hiding. He's composing himself, trying to get back into it. But like Dimmy has caught him in this moment of weakness. He like comes over with the stole and the glasses and he says, father. And like, again, it's hard to read that as a priestly title in this situation, right? Like he's helping his father recover from, I don't know, like maybe a dizzy spell or a moment of senility or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Marin turns from the wall and you can see him coming back from wherever he was. Right. You see him wake back up. But I can also see shame on his face at being caught like this. He holds out his hand to take, you know, the stuff, but he doesn't look up at Dimmy. And maybe, again, maybe he's still out of it. He's discombobulated. But this is the first time I can remember that he has had an interaction with someone and not looked them in the eye. And that's awful.
Right, because he takes such pains to show him looking in the eye of the tea shop owner and Jesuit Dean, because they have, sorry, that's not his name, but they have, you know, he has a similar moment, right, where he comes out of time in the Museum of Antiquities, and it seems like the clock isn't working, and he's literally out of time. And then he sees the, what brings him back is his friend, right?
Is his friend the curator, right? And yeah, like think of... Folks, think back on all the scenes with Marin and all of his interactions. He's always looking people right in the eye, right? Like when he shows up at Chris's door, right? They're looking at each other, right? He says, "What is your daughter's middle name?" He is always looking at people and, you know, not in a like searching way. Like he's seeing them, right? Like he's that look that he gives them is this paternal, like I see you, it's okay, you're safe, right? And he can't do that. This is the only time in the movie so far that I remember that he can't look somebody in the eye, and that like it breaks your heart. It's awful.
Yeah. Just one other thing that we're doing camera wise. So I don't know if this is getting too far into the weeds, but we are what's called crossing the line. So there's this invisible line between the actors' noses, essentially, that wherever they're looking at each other. So if they're looking at each other, then the rule of like continuity style of filmmaking is that the camera should always be on one side of that line. And as long as you do that, no matter where the camera is, if Damien is looking right, then Marin is looking left. And if you put the cameras on the other side of the line, then you get what's called a line cross or crossing the line or breaking the 180-degree rule. There's a bunch of different ways that they say that, unfortunately, which makes it confusing sometimes to teach it because film students might have heard it three or four different ways. But essentially what we're doing is that we are purposefully crossing the line so that as Damien comes out, we're on his right side when we should be, according to the rules of continuity, be on his left side. It's making it this discontinuous, like fragmented view. So the reason we have the continuity style where people are always looking in the same screen direction is that's the way that when we're watching a real argument or a conversation, say between people you care about, your parents having a fight or something, you're always looking left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right. That's just how it is in the real world. Movies in the continuity style try to keep that. When we break that, it's not, we say it as a rule, but people break it all the time for emphasis. And so this is part of the things that gives this shot where Damien's coming out of the bathroom, this chaotic, frenetic sort of feel to it. Because we've crossed the line of where our cameras, quote unquote, should be. And our screen direction is flipped. And it makes it feel, again, when Damien is coming over to Marin, that they're not quite connecting in the same way because they're not quite obeying the way that we would be able to observe their conversation in real life. We're essentially stifling our impulse to be able to maintain that. When I'm looking at Damien, I'm looking at the right side of my field of vision. When I'm looking at Marin, I'm looking at the left side. So we've crossed the line, and it feels like they're having trouble connecting with each other, if you will.
Oh, that is really, and that's another thing that like we can feel, even though we don't notice the actual mechanics of it being done.
Yes, exactly. Oh. Yeah, most people wouldn't recognize, you know, audience members wouldn't recognize why, but they sort of feel like, yeah, something is weird here. Something is off here.
Oh, that is
cool. Oftentimes you read it as a mistake, but it's clearly not a mistake here because this is William Friedkin, Owen Roisman, and they know what they're doing.
Right. Oh, I love... See, this is like... I love how you bring this stuff to our show, Keenan.
Oh,
like,
good.
Like,
I hope I'm not boring people. that's my fear always.
And I think people have said that they love this kind of stuff.
Okay, so good.
Yeah.
Phew.
Yeah.
Just like me.
Yeah.
Like my new podcast, like I'm your toilet. That's all I want.
Yeah. There you go. See, folks, we're... We're peanut butter and chocolate. You figure out what that means for yourself.
Yeah. Taking down notes. Lester, toilet, peanut butter, chocolate. Got it.
Uh-huh. Yep. Oh, yeah. Okay. So yeah, we were talking about this look that they're giving each other, or this look that Dimmy has given him, and he can't meet Dimmy's gaze.
Right.
And we were talking about how awful that is.
Yeah.
Awful for us, but it is apparently hilarious for Captain Howdy.
That's right. Yes.
We cut, and he is yucking it up on that bed.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, Keenan, I want to talk about this cackling that has been going on. Cackling is the only word for it. But is this ambiguous?
Mm.
Like, we talked before about the other time when Howdy was moaning and it was a little bit ambiguous.
Right.
But what about here? Like, does it sound like there might be a little bit of pain in this laughter as well? Or is it just like straight up like having a good time laughing?
For me, it's not ambiguous, but it is like, I think we know at each moment, but it is vacillating between pain and pleasure. It's between pain and laughter. Yeah. Cause it's this crazy things McCambridge is doing where it sounds like she's in pain and then it becomes laughter and then that laughter becomes pain. So I wouldn't call that ambiguous necessarily, but it certainly is going through those waves. Yeah. And then, yeah, again, we didn't see what happened when we were in the bathroom with Damien. So like, where is this coming from?
Yeah.
We were not with Howdy and Marin when Damien was in the bathroom. We were with Damien. So something has happened and we don't know what that has made Marin start to break his psyche and then has allowed Howdy to get the upper hand and experience fun again. So we don't know what that is. And it's so disconcerting, right? Because the last time we had them, right, it was just pain, just nothing but pain, like unambiguous pain.
Right. If I had to guess, Howdy said something.
Mm-hmm.
Like turns around, he's like, oh, how's Clancy? You know, or something like that. I mean, I didn't mean that to be funny, but you know what I mean?
Yes,
Like for Dimmy, it's, you know, your mother sucks cocks in hell.
Right.
But for Marin, it's like, Clancy,
well,
you know.
What terrible thing happened to Clancy? Well, I'm sure there's only one or two things that could have happened to Clancy the duck.
I mean,
you don't just have pet ducks in the fields of England in the 1910s when Marin was growing up. Yeah.
No. Hey, you remember that Christmas dinner when your mom and dad said Clancy ran away?
Oh, God.
What was the main course of that Christmas dinner, if I may be so?
It was Christmas goose. It was Christmas goose.
Oh, sure. But no, like in all seriousness, I think that's what I think it was. I think he... Because we know, like, Howdy is good with words.
Yes.
And he can say something, you know, just like he makes Karis fall to pieces, like, just by, like, well, so it's you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So he has, and he knows, I think he knows Marin a little bit better.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So he can say something, and that might be enough to get to Marin. Even though, you know, in previous minutes, I was talking about how Marin is not playing Howdy's games. Marin is not even listening to Howdy. Marin is a machine, and he is an exterminator, and he is not even paying attention to the words, you know, coming out of like Reagan/Howdy's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
But all you need is just like a little break in the action.
Right.
That washing of the glasses, that washing of the stole. He's by himself. There's nobody else. And it's just like a little bit of silence and then boom.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But yeah, back to Howdy's laughing here. Mm-hmm. For me, there's definitely something more than just mirth.
Mm-hmm.
I like what you said about the vacillating between pain and pleasure, Keenan. I also like the idea that the exorcism is like a strong anesthesia.
Uh-huh.
And Howdy is like waking up from it.
Right. I like that.
So he's like still feeling the weight of it, right? He's still like drugged, but the pleasure at causing Marin pain outweighs his own pain. I'm also thinking of like Heath Ledger's Joker laughing as Batman like punches him.
Mm-hmm.
He's physically feeling pain probably, but like he can't tamp down the laughter inside of him.
Right.
And I will say, Yes, of all the howdy noises, this is the second most disturbing for me. Sounds just like the hag again, but it's the hag laughing. And it's the hag doing more than the, like, operatic villain laugh. This is the, like, drugged laugh of an insane person.
Right. That's great.
Yeah. So we cut to a close-up of Marin and Karis in profile. Karis is helping Marin with his vestments. Marin has already donned his glasses, vestments of his age, and now he kisses the purple stole before donning that as well. And he is once again the exorcist. But still, it looks like, and I can't quite tell, Keenan, help me out here. Does he look Karis in the eye here?
Yeah. So now I'm pulling it up and the answer is no, no. Marin goes to, his eyes are kind of flitting and blinking out of embarrassment and sort of shame. Yeah, they do not actually connect with Damien. No.
Yeah. And I don't think Dimmy can look him in the eye either. Right.
Right.
Except maybe at like the very end when he turns, right. There's, there's a quick glance up at his eyes. He wants to see how much this has affected his father. And again, like we see characters keep doing that. Like once Marin's turned away, people are like stealing glances at him. Chris does that when she hands him the coffee, like he takes a sip and that's when she, you know, looks at him. Dimmy does that when, you know, like after he had just been admonished with there is only one,
right.
And Marin turns and he kind of like looks after him. And now he's doing it again. He's looking at his father and seeing if he is all right. But Marin has already turned away. However he's feeling, whatever is in his heart, and whether it's the heart of a child or the heart of a tired old man, he is getting back in there. He is facing his destiny. And that is where our minute ends. And that is all of my notes. Keenan, is there anything else?
No, I think that was really great, Lester. I think we got it.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think we did a great job.
All right, yeah.
Folks, this has been another excellent Exorcist Minute. I've been Lester Ryan Clark. You can reach me on all the socials as Lester Ryan Clark.
And I've been Keenan Diaz. You could find me on Instagram and Letterboxd at Howdy Keenan.
Yeah, we got our listener group, Compelling Conversations. Go check that out and request to join, and we'll let you in here with us. Thank you so much to everyone who has shared the show by word of mouth or on social media. And a big thank you to everyone who has given us a 5-star ratings on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you listen to our show. We really appreciate that. It's going to help our little podcast grow and find more cool people like you. Okay, Keenan, are you thinking what I'm thinking?
I think I am, Lester.
Folks, until next time,
the power of Clancy the Duck compels you. What do you think happened to Clancy the Duck?
Well, I'm going to assume that Clancy was Catholic also. And I'm hoping for the Assumption of Clancy. He does not die. He just rises up to heaven as Clancy. And he's going to meet Father Marin when... You know, when Father Marin gets there.
I like it.
Yeah.
But now all I could think of it is Mr. Marin and Mrs. Marin leaning over and going, oh, now Lancaster, be sure to Assumption Clancy. Consumption all of Clancy you can. Yes. It's the only thing we get to eat this week.
You know, we know so little about this character. Not Clancy. I'm talking about Marin.
We know nothing about Clancy.
We know nothing about Clancy.
So therefore, he's our favorite.
But I'm talking like what does that mean? Like he had a duck when he was little. Like, as like, did he live on a farm? Did he like what's going on there? Like.
Well, him being as old as he is.
Was it in Sweden?
I think he's English, right? English? I don't know. We don't even know what country he's from in the book. He's English in the movie. Yeah. He's Swedish for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Like, Cito is Swedish, but yeah, mm-hmm. like, Marin is, we don't know.
Yeah, Lancaster Marin, yeah.
Lancaster, Lancaster. So he says where it's is named this, after a bridge. Where is, wait, hang on.
We're going to find
where
this duck.
In the world is there a bridge named Lancaster? I wasn't able to find a bridge specifically named Lancaster. It's possible there might be a bridge with a similar name or a local name that's not widely recognized in online sources. If you have more context about the bridge's location or its significance, Father Marin was named after a bridge, he says. What you know what? What is the origin of Lancaster?
Mm-hmm.
There we go. This'll do it. Okay. The name Lancaster could be a variant of Lancaster, which has origins related to a place name and surname in England. Okay. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Lancaster itself comes from the city of Lancaster in Lancashire, northwest England. The name of the city is derived from the River Loon and the old English term keister, which was used to denote a Roman fort or town. So mm-hmm. Loon keister. Eventually evolved into Lancaster. Mm-hmm. This place name has been...
Yes, and Marin comes from the English East Midlands habitational name for Mareham, Mareham on the hill. Mareham on the hill became Marin.
Okay, interesting. But now, so it's a very, very English name.
Very English. I look for Clancy the Duck, and what I get is... recipe, smoked duck, New Orleans style.
Oh, Jesus. This is all I can think of now is this is Marin's dark past. Something happened with Clancy the Duck, and it's like, did Captain Howdy possess Clancy?
What, and walk him into the path of an axe?
I don't know. Like, I think it would just be enough that your beloved pet duck is, you know, saying that your mother sucks cocks in hell.
Quack, 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 quack.
Yeah. Is just talking.
You are not real. Right? It's not real. Don't listen to him. Quack, 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 quack.
You're not Clancy. Lanky, please. Why you do this to me, Lanky? It's the exact same scenario.
It's exact same thing.
But he's in Dimmy's spot.
Right,
Lanky, they're gonna take me out back and they're gonna make me Christmas dinner.
Who has money for nice duck sanctuary? You? On your salary?
He takes a bus to the city. It takes an hour just so he can visit Clancy. And Clancy is always so happy to see him. Right? And he calls him Lanky. And he's got an uncle also who is a duck somehow.
Right, yes.
For some reason. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it's that, you know, like we saw Dimmy looking through the glass and it looked like chicken wire. But Marin is actually looking through chicken wire.
That's right.